Yeah, I feel just reading widely helped me understand sort of the bounds of the form. Like I said, like heavy memoir with little bits of science, heavy science, bits of memoir. I think just having in my head like everything that this form can encompass helped me to build my own out.
Hello and welcome to Emerging Form. I'm Christy Ashwanden.
I'm Rosemary Wetola-Tromer, and this is a podcast on creative process. Hi, Christy.
Hey, Rosemary. How's it going?
Awesome. I'm wondering about why we do what we do.
Why we do. Well, I think a lot of us feel like our creative work is a bit of a calling. Would you say that's true?
I mean, in a way, because I think if you could do something else that made more money or took a lot less work, you might.
Right.
So
right.
If that's the definition, what do you think the definition of a calling is anyway?
Oh, that's a good question. A calling. I mean, I think it's something you feel compelled to do and that you're passionate about and that you are doing for sort of intrinsic reasons rather than extrinsic. You know,
that's a beautiful answer,
Christy. Your calling is not something you do for money. You do it for passion and love, right?
Yeah, that's really well said.
Yeah. And I think it's really on topic because our guests today, our conversation, we get into this a little bit and sort of the upsides and downsides, right, to doing work that feels like a calling.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like your work is a calling?
I do. How about you, Rosemary?
I don't think I used to, but now I do.
Ooh, what changed?
I think I started believing in myself more. I think that I started to think this is actually, I think I went from thinking this is an impossibility to this is something that is possible over time. And it came from just doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it, of course. But I think that part of it feeling like a calling, I wonder if part of it has to do with you feel the intrinsic rewards of it more and more and more. And then in a way you also, the extrinsic rewards support it too.
I think that's so interesting that you say that because to me a calling is more intrinsic. And you're saying that when you start to have extrinsic rewards, that then it feels like a calling. But I wonder if what you're really trying to say is that once you feel like what you're doing makes some difference or
That it matters beyond
that
me.
It matters.
That's well said, sweetheart. Okay. That is totally right. That it matters beyond me and that it puts me in service to the world in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't mean it. I don't mean money. I mean, and I don't mean success, whatever that means.
Well, what
I
is
mean,
success? That's a whole nother.
We've
had that discussion
that
too many times to revisit right now. Yeah.
But to feel like, oh, this matters mm-hmm. beyond Rosemary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. And part of that is being able to, you know, feel like you're creating something that you're sharing and that is sort of going out into the world and landing somewhere.
And you feel in service. I think mm-hmm. that's it. That it feels like it's in service to something greater.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I absolutely feel that with both of my jobs, you know, with my executive director job, you know, building community, I'm really connecting with people. I'm helping people, you know, enrich their well-being. That feels so rewarding. And it does feel like a calling because I believe in it so deeply. And then, you know, with my writing, the same thing. It's a different thing in that I'm not necessarily building community there, but I am getting information out into the world that could help people. And I think that's part of it for sure. Well, Rosemary, why don't you introduce this week's guest?
I'm excited. She has a new book called Unrooted: Botany, Motherhood, and the Fight to Save an Old Science. And she, Erin Zimmerman, is an evolutionary biologist turned science writer and essayist. She studied at the University of Guelph and at the University of Montreal before traveling to South America to collect plant specimens. And then she worked at the Royal Botanic Gardens in England. In addition to her academic writing, her essays have appeared in publications including Smithsonian Magazine, Los Angeles Review of Books, Undark, and Narratively. Let's bring on Erin.
Yeah.
Welcome to Emerging Form.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're so glad to have you here, Erin.
So, Erin, for people who haven't read your book yet, could you just give us a short overview of it? What's it about? What's its scope? That kind of thing.
Sure. So the book, it's part science and part memoir. It uses my story as a PhD student and through my postdoc and shortly thereafter to explore two of the issues that I noticed when I was in science and kind of couldn't let go of when I left, because I didn't feel they were getting enough attention. The first is the undervaluing and underfunding of natural history-based science. So this is like observational specimen-based research. This asks, what is this species? Where does it live? How does it live? How is it related to other species? It's how we know our world. It's very fundamental research. And because it looks very similar to the way it was done 100 or 200 years ago in some ways, it has an image problem. It looks old-fashioned. But 45% of all plant species are threatened, known plant species are threatened with extinction, like nearly half of all plant species. And that's the ones we know. There are a projected 100,000 species that we don't even know yet, that many of which will go extinct before we even discover them. So this is urgent work. We need to be getting out there, collecting, looking at specimens and learning about our world. The other issue is the treatment of mothers in science, the experience of mothers in science. This is something I experienced for myself. I became a parent when I was a postdoc. And women are typically the primary caregiver of their children early in life, not always, but usually. And scientific research is very competitive. It's a calling. It's all or nothing sort of thing. So there is not the accommodation given to looking after young children, to having those caregiving responsibilities in the form of, I mean, at least in my case, like different working schedules or being understanding about like gaps in publication record when it comes time to go in front of a tenure committee, that sort of thing. And it's bad enough that according to an 8-year-long study, nearly half of American women working in STEM fields will leave full-time STEM employment after having their first child. And that's a huge loss.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a huge loss to science, and it's a huge loss to those women who will have spent their entire adult lives getting to that point. So these are the two issues that I explore in the book through my own experiences.
And I think that's the what of the book. Was that what you set out to do? Is this is what I'm going to write about? Or did that emerge as you were going? In other words, did you always know it was going to be a memoir and that the motherhood was going to be part of it too? Or did you think it was going to be memoir and then also the other part came in? Or how did they weave together?
I knew first that I wanted to write about natural history research. And I did consider at the very beginning maybe just writing a straight science book. There's certainly enough material for it. But my own research is the connective, or my own experience, I should say, is the connective material between the two points I'm making. Like more and more, I felt that I also wanted to write about mothers and science. And these two topics look very separate on paper, but they happen to me concurrently, and I wanted to be able to talk about them both. And to me, they're both a loss of diversity in two different ways. So my story formed the connection between the two, but also I really love first-person science writing. I love when writers can take a scientific concept, apply it to their own lives, and kind of find emotional resonance in it. And I think you can draw in a wider audience that way, because there are a lot of people who wouldn't pick up a straight science book. And because of the issues I'm writing about, I wanted to not just preach to the choir. There are people who wouldn't pick up a science book necessarily, but who would pick up a memoir about a woman in science. So I think that was part of why I felt that it needed to be a memoir.
So the book has a lot of science. It has a story, obviously. It also has history. It's very complex. And I found that there wasn't just one or the other. There was a lot of both. And I just wonder, as you were writing, how did you sort of figure out the right length, saw the structure, the form of the book? Was that something that you sort of knew from the beginning? How did you figure out how the structure would come together?
I spent a lot of time planning the structure of this book. It is complex, and it was difficult for me to put it together in a way that made sense. I've noticed science memoirs exist on a spectrum. Like, if you look at something like Lab Girl, it's almost straight memoir with sort of science interludes, and others are just bits of memoir in amongst a lot of reporting. I wanted to go straight down the middle. I work in Scrivener, and
oh yeah,
I love Scrivener. Most writers do, I think.
This is something Rosemary and I have an ongoing dispute about. For some reason, she doesn't like it.
Oh no,
I don't understand. I'll never understand. We just need to disagree on this.
Well, one of the things it does is it allows you to chop up the entire book into tiny little sections, and you can actually color code them and look at them on a timeline, which is really like. So I actually sort of kept a casual eye on what the balance was in each chapter to try to keep it a bit even, because I liked going back and forth a lot, and I felt like it was the best way to hold readers' attention. Mind you, the book actually got shuffled a fair bit in edits, so I don't know if that balance is still there. But
was this something where you were sort of like, hey, I figured it out, I'm going to do it like this, and here's the structure? Or were you like, oh, wait, that's not working? Or was it kind of a work in progress, it sounds?
Yeah, the earlier chapters were very heavily planned, whereas I wasn't quite sure how I was going to finish this until I wrote it. So the ending was in flux. And
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. In fact, what is now the last chapter, which is on citizen science, was originally a fairly short epilogue. But my editor said, no, this is useful. This is the take home for people who are not in science, because I talk about like how people who care about species loss can get involved. So that ended up getting built out into a full chapter, and I'm happy we did that. So yeah, the ending was really up in the air for quite a while.
I'm wondering, as you were writing this, were you reading other memoirs, and what were you taking for them? Like, what are some books that you read and said, okay, I want it to be like this, like, or not like this? Or, you know, were there other works that really informed your own book?
I was definitely reading other science memoirs. I love the genre. I mentioned Lab Girl. I enjoyed Julie Burwald's Spineless. That's a great book. And Cassandra Quave's book, Plant Hunter, which is probably the closest comparable one to mine. She did such a nice job on hers. Those are all by, well, no, not Julie's, but like Lab Girl and Plant Hunter are by active scientists. They are writing these books alongside active research, which blows me away. But
well, let's be honest, you are writing your book alongside being an active mother.
True.
So that's about the same thing.
It's own challenge for sure. Yeah, I feel just reading widely helped me understand sort of the bounds of the form. Like I said, like heavy memoir with little bits of science, heavy science, bits of memoir. I think just having in my head like everything that this form can encompass helped me to build my own out.
What surprised you as you were writing this? I mean, it sounds like you didn't know that the ending was going to be, you know, this little chapter on the citizens, but what else surprised you about what happened while you were writing this book?
What surprised me? Lydia Becker was a surprise to me. I didn't know about her when I started writing. She was someone I bumbled into while doing the research. And I ended up focusing on her, obviously, more than I had realized I would, because she was such a good example of women trying to be a part of science at a time when they were actively being pushed out of botany specifically. And I talk a bit about Charles Darwin in the book because on a personal level, he was an inspiration to me, specifically because he did his best work at a time when he was kind of stuck at home. He had a lot of children and he was living in a rural area, and he, because of his health, was unable to travel. His life showed me that, you can be stuck in, not stuck, but rooted in one place, let's say, and still reach out into the world and do important things. And Lydia Becker, like, that had been sort of a view I had held for some time, but Lydia Becker, as it turns out, saw him the same way. And spoke to other women on this topic, like, look at this person doing amazing things despite having a life like ours, in a way, because women were very tied to the home at that time. And yet, it's worth noting that she was eventually forced to contend with the flip side of that. Darwin got much more into sort of biological essentialism later on and was more dismissive of women and their intelligence and abilities, and had to cope with having been disappointed by her hero, which we're reckoning with that a lot these days. You know, these giants of science being brought down because they held some very unsettling views sometimes. So yeah, that was a great surprise learning about her.
I want to pivot back and ask, I just feel like it wouldn't be complete, this interview, without asking about these gorgeous illustrations that you created that are in the book. They're so beautiful, but I'm really curious to know a little bit about what it's like, you know, creating the illustrations versus the text and sort of how the interplay between those two, you know, is one easier or more difficult than the other? In what kind of order did you do them? Like, how did that come about?
Oh, sure. I did the illustrations between finishing the manuscript and doing the edits on it. So it was a wonderful change of pace just to get to do something different for a while. I did a fair bit of illustration during my PhD, and I then found it a nice change of pace as well, because it's, you can shut off the analytical part of your brain and it's more of a visual comparative hand-to-eye sensation. I like being able to switch gears in that way. And yeah, mind you, it's its own kind of discipline, because ink is very unforgiving. It does not erase. If you've made a mistake, it's there. I did a couple of these over again. One point I dropped the pen, onto what I was drawing and lost several hours of work. But something I discuss in the book, there's a chapter that deals a lot with botanical illustration and how research has found that we learn better from drawing, in a way. If you're trying to understand a plant, to remember it, to understand how the different parts work together, the way you have to look at it, the intensity with which you have to experience its form in order to draw it, helps you to remember and understand it holistically much better. I wanted to have the drawings to go along with that point.
That's fascinating. So that the just kind of using the drawing as a way of knowing and understanding and really bringing it into your body.
Yes, absolutely. Once you've drawn a plant, you kind of remember it forever.
Yeah, of course. That makes so much sense.
It's a way of really forcing yourself to have a particular type of observation, right? To write. You can't gloss over the details. You really have to notice those details, right?
You do. Yeah. When we study the morphology of a plant, we have like sort of a checklist of features that like you're noting the form of each of a large number of different features. But those sort of binary or multi-choice checklists, they don't capture the way the different parts relate to each other or the subtlety of some of the shapes. Whereas when you draw it, you have to have that holistic understanding. You have to understand how the parts relate to one another. And it really is a different experience of understanding the plant's form.
Well, and then I'm just curious, too, that you did these in chunks. You know, here's the writing chunk, and now I'm doing the illustration chunk, and now I'm back to writing chunk. Have you ever tried going back and forth, drawing, writing?
This is the first time I have had them together in one project this way. Really, it's nice. I don't multitask well, so I needed to be doing one or the other at a time. But it's really refreshing just to get to change gears like that.
So there is this line that you had in the book that I wanted to ask you about. And that is, this really resonated with me, by the way. You talk about how in framing scientific research as a calling, that it really leads people sort of down a toxic road where they end up doing things they shouldn't do, like unreasonably long hours, long-term instability. Like basically that when you are thinking of your work as a calling, you're sort of willing to put up with abuse that you wouldn't do otherwise if you weren't considering it with that framing. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, writing and science absolutely are both callings. Yeah. And unfortunately, I think we as a society will take as much as we can from people who do their work because they love it and they'll do it anyway. And that love and devotion will take you a long way. It'll last a long time. But eventually, if you're not seeing the return in terms of income or stability or recognition, whatever it takes to sort of fulfill you that way, you burn out. Journalists burn out all the time, certainly. Scientists do too, for various reasons. And as far as scientists go, training a scientist is a big investment. It's a long-term thing, and there's a lot of cost involved. But we're not exactly safeguarding that investment very well. If we're not supporting scientists early in their career when they don't yet have the return on all that work that they have done. So that's something that we need to think about. And yes, unfortunately, that's the arts is rife with that as well.
What is it for you, Erin? What is you mentioned income, stability, recognition. What is it that looks like, okay, yeah, I can keep doing this. I love it, but I'll keep doing it also because I've been rewarded this way.
As a writer or as a scientist?
Both, either.
I think, obviously everyone needs income, but recognition does help a lot. You know, when the work is solitary in both cases in a lot of ways, and just being recognized for what you've done is worth a lot. And I would say, like you asked about identity, I still identify as a scientist. I do, because the training is still there and because I still think like a scientist. I guess that's a very hard thing to step away from. But I'm happy to be away from those problems, I think. Because at least for me, as a freelancer, I don't want to say exploitation, but like the underpay feels a little bit more on my terms than it did as a scientist. You know, as a freelancer, you can negotiate what you're willing to put up with. And as a scientist, you can't.
You said something that surprised me. It shouldn't, I suppose, but I want to ask more about it. You mentioned that both being a scientist and a writer are solitary pursuits. Which reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from A.R. Ammons. He says about poetry, who would want to sit alone in a room all day picking away at their own liver? I get that we do it for love. But my question is then, I guess, where are you finding community when you're not alone in it? Do you have a place you find community? And now I am specifically asking about writing.
Sure. I've been fortunate enough to have met a number of writers online. I almost never see other writers in real life. But this being 2024, I mean, it's possible to form great relationships and community online. And there are people that I speak to every day, but have never met. I have a writing partner who I've been checking in. We check in every week with each other and have been doing so since 2017. We've never met in real life.
Wow.
Yeah, and I value her enormously.
How did you connect?
We were both writing for a little Canadian publication, volunteer-run publication called Science Borealis. The idea was to sort of help new Canadian science communicators build up their chops and get some bylines.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I also, once a week, because I'm a solitary person. I actually do really like spending a lot of time alone, but I recognize my own limits and a person can get too far into their own head. Once a week, I do spend an afternoon as working as like a companion to an elderly person in the community. And I love that as a change of gear because I am out of the house and I am talking to someone who does not know me as a writer or as a science person or as anything except the person who comes and spends time with him and helps him out. And while I'm there, it's a way to turn it all off, I guess. It's the few hours of my week when I'm not thinking about writing or science or parenting for that matter. So yeah, I think it's really important, even if you're someone who loves being solitary very much, to get out and not be in your own head all the time.
What a great point. What an interesting way. You know, we've had so many different people have different ways that, you know, a lot of people, it's walking, just getting outside and walking away. But even then, it's more of a way to get out and still be thinking about it, you know, except without, you know, your work right in front of you. And I think one of the differences about what you're saying is, no, you get to turn it all the way off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important for me. I want to not be thinking about it at all for a little while.
That feels like a nice note to end on. What a wonderful conversation this has been. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Erin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for those of you who are paid subscribers, you will get a special bonus episode next week where Erin will talk about her process and some of the highlights of writing this book. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Emerging Form. This is Rosemary Wetolet-Romer, and my co-host is science writer Christy Ashwanden. Our fabulous audio producer is Cherie Turner, and our music is created and performed by Kira Kopostansky and edited by Leah Shaw. Kate LaRue designed our logo, and Jack Mueller, of course, inspired our work and the name of this podcast. As he always said, you must obey the poem's emerging form. Until next time.
Thanks for listening to Emerging Form. Did you know that for just a few bucks a month, you can become a paid subscriber?